This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
This is the BBC.
Hi, I'm David Aronovich. This is The Briefing Room, a podcast that tries to make sense of the news. What on earth is going on in Washington? FBI directors, national security directors, the Justice Department, Senate and House committee hearings, and even the I word, impeachment. And now, as of last night, a special prosecutor. It all adds up to trouble for President Trump, but how much trouble? Tonight, in the briefing room, with the help of a former FBI special agent and expert on national security law and others, you and I will be making sense of the Trump affair. If you want to understand it all, step into the briefing room. First, how did we get here? The briefing room's Neil Rozelle has done us a timeline.
Trump, Russia, and the FBI. For the casual listener, it all might be a bit of a blur. For the careful listener, it might be overwhelming. So let's take it one step at a time from the beginning. July 2013, Barack Obama nominates James Comey as director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
It is in large part because of my confidence, not only in his experience and his skill, but his integrity, that I'm confident that Jim will be a leader who understands how to keep America safe and stay true to our founding ideals, no matter what the future may bring.
In October 2013, James Comey laid out his vision at a ceremony to welcome him at FBI headquarters.
First, the FBI must be independent of all political forces or interests in this country. In a real sense, it must stand apart from other institutions in American life.
Before him, some of the 35,000 FBI officers and staff who investigate America's most complex and sensitive cases, from organized crime to terrorism to foreign espionage. Leading them is a big job. It's perhaps a relief to anyone who does it that, by law, you have to stand down after 10 years.
The term is 10 years to ensure independence, but it is a fixed term of years to ensure that power does not become concentrated in one person and unconstrained.
Mr. Comey goes on to reference two former FBI directors whose names aren't important. His sentiment is,
the need for reflection and restraint of power is what led Louis Freeh to order that all new agent classes visit the Holocaust Museum here in Washington so they could see and feel and hear in a palpable way the consequences of abuse of power on a massive, almost unimaginable scale. Bob Mueller continued that practice, and I will again when we have agents graduating from Quantico.
So here we have a new director who values reflection, restraint, and above all, independence. He wouldn't enter American public consciousness for another 3 years.
Good morning. I'm here to give you an update on the FBI's investigation of Secretary Clinton's use of a personal email system during her time as Secretary of State.
July 2016. The race to replace Barack Obama is in full swing.
This is going to be an unusual statement in at least a couple of ways. First, I'm going to include more detail about our process than I ordinarily would, because I think the American people deserve those details in a case of intense public interest. And second, I have not coordinated this statement or reviewed it in any way with the Department of Justice or any other part of the government. They do not know what I'm about to say.
What he'd say was he didn't think Hillary Clinton should be charged.
How can you possibly say no charges?
Donald Trump on the stump hours later.
And what he said today was so bad.
The next day,
the FBI director said Hillary failed to turn over several thousand work-related emails, including emails that were classified. Right? Rigged system, folks.
And the next week,
the rigged system refused to prosecute her for conduct that put all of us, everybody in this room, everybody in this country, at risk.
It was at this time, in July, that the FBI opened an investigation into the Trump campaign and its alleged connections with the Russian government, led by James Comey. But none of that was made public. On October 28th, 11 days before the election, James Comey told Congress in a letter that he had new information and he was reopening the investigation into Hillary Clinton. He'd later say,
"Look, this was terrible. It makes me mildly nauseous to think that we might have had some impact on the election. But honestly, it wouldn't change the decision."
On the campaign trail, Donald Trump leapt on it.
"And I have to give the FBI credit. That was so bad what happened originally, and it took guts for Director Comey to make the move that he made. It took a lot of guts. I really disagreed with him. I was not his fan. But I'll tell you what he did, he brought back his reputation."
That estimation would be short-lived. A week later, just 2 days before the election, the FBI director sent Congress another letter that effectively said, forget about that last one. We still don't think Hillary should be charged.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable what she gets away with.
Mr. Trump made it a central part of his closing pitch to voters.
Hillary Clinton is guilty. She knows it. The FBI knows it. The people know it. And now it's up to the American people to deliver justice at the ballot box on November 8th.
We know the rest of that story. In the weeks after the election, America's intelligence services concluded that Russia had tried to influence the outcome. The FBI continued to investigate connections to the Trump campaign. And in January of this year, we have the first public encounter between now President Trump and the FBI director.
The inauguration was such a success.
And it's a reception for law enforcement officers. Mr. Trump spots Director Comey across the room and blows him a kiss.
"Oh, and there's James.
He's become more famous than me."
Mr. Comey wrings his hands and walks towards him. They shake hands and hug. The next phase of their relationship becomes more contentious. It happens behind closed doors. In January, the two men dined together. The president reportedly asked the FBI director if he had his loyalty. The reported response, "You have my honesty." President Trump says the FBI director told him he wasn't under investigation. They met again in February, a day after Mr. Trump's national security advisor, Mike Flynn, resigned over allegations he'd misled the White House about his connections to Russia. The New York Times reports that Mr. Comey wrote a memo after this meeting in which the president said, "I hope you can see your way clear to letting this go." The White House denies it. In March, differences between the two men again became public. Mr. Trump tweeted, without evidence, that Barack Obama had tapped his phones before the election. Mr. Comey said,
"With respect to the president's tweets about alleged wiretapping directed at him by the prior administration, I have no information that supports those tweets, and we have looked carefully inside the FBI."
Mr. Comey also publicly confirmed for the first time that the FBI was investigating links between Russia and the Trump campaign. It's reported that in the following weeks, he asked for more resources for that investigation. Donald Trump fired James Comey last Tuesday and set off an extraordinary chain of events. The White House press office initially said it was because of his handling of the Clinton case, specifically talking about the investigation in such a public way during the campaign. Nothing to do with Russia. But then the president himself spoke to Lester Holt of NBC News.
"He's a showboat. He's a grandstander. I was going to fire Comey. My decision. Regardless of recommendation, I was going to fire Comey. And in fact, when I decided to just do it, I said to myself, you know, this Russia thing with Trump and Russia is a made-up story. It's an excuse by the Democrats for having lost an election.
But are you angry with Mr. Comey because of his Russia investigation?
I just want somebody that's competent.
He said he wanted the Russia investigation speeded up. He certainly made it more intense. The Senate is tonight hearing testimony about the Comey firing, and there's a row about whether he shared classified information with the Russian foreign minister in the days following the sacking. There's even talk of impeachment. Donald Trump's troubles are piling up. Mr. Comey, meanwhile, hasn't spoken publicly since he was fired. He did write a farewell letter to his FBI colleagues. A president can fire an FBI director for any reason, it said, or for no reason at all.
Neil Rozell there. So, what do we know about the reasons for an investigation into the Trump campaign in the first place? The BBC's Paul Wood in Washington has taken a special interest in this question.
We should stress, first of all, that they are allegations and that nothing, not one single fact, has emerged proving some nefarious link. Of course, the answer to that is, well, it's classified and it's part of an ongoing investigation. But the main allegations are threefold. Firstly, that the Trump campaign entered into a treasonous conspiracy with Russia to steal the presidential election. Specifically, Democratic Party politicians were hacked and the resulting information was leaked out in coordination with the Trump campaign as part of a sophisticated propaganda effort. Secondly, the allegation is that Mr. Trump had a long-running business relationship with a lot of people, let's say, whose cash was suspect from the former Soviet Union. And out of that alleged money laundering relationship grew a relationship with Russian intelligence. Intelligence people will tell you that the Russian mob, which is very much connected to the Kremlin, deliberately targeted Mr. Trump in the early 2000s because they thought he'd gone bankrupt or his companies had gone bankrupt four times in Atlantic City and he would take money, whatever the source. And they were trying to move into New York real estate and New York gambling and so started buying up Trump property. Once again, you have to show that Donald Trump had knowledge of this. And so what these various investigations, the Senate and the FBI, are trying to do is show a pattern. And once again, we have to stress that nothing public has been produced, which is damning. Thirdly, the allegation is that Mr. Trump, President Trump, is vulnerable to blackmail by the Russians because they have so-called compromat on him. This would be specifically a sex tape made in Russia, made in St. Petersburg and Moscow. Allegedly, the rather kind of baroque detail is that some prostitutes were paid to urinate on a bed that had been once used by President and Mrs. Obama. So taking those three allegations together, essentially the claim is that the man in the White House now is vulnerable to blackmail by the Russians, is somehow a creature of the Russians, is a Russian agent of influence. We must stress again, no actual evidence of this has been produced.
OK, so now we have the background and the principal actors. Let's bring them together and talk about the investigations themselves. Asha Rangappa is a former FBI special agent. She's now an associate dean at Yale Law School and she teaches national security law. Asha Rangappa, let's start with the FBI investigation. We'll come to talk about the special counsel or special prosecutor in a moment. What do we know about the lines of inquiry of that investigation?
So you have what is essentially and primarily a counterintelligence investigation. This is an investigation into a Russian intelligence attempt to influence our 2016 election. And the main questions here are, how did they do it? Why did they do it? And how can we shore up our defenses to prevent it from happening again?
You've worked on FBI intelligence investigations in the past. Looking at it from the outside, you'd have thought that the sacking of the FBI director would have quite an impact on the investigation.
It won't have a practical impact. On the ground, and as far as actual investigations go, he doesn't direct the investigation down in the weeds. FBI investigators are there to get to the bottom of whatever case they are working on. And you're not going to just abandon a case in the middle. And you couldn't abandon a case without explaining why you're doing it. So the ball will keep rolling.
So what about this image that some of us have in our heads that, you know, when the FBI director goes and goes under these circumstances, maybe some of the incriminating files get carefully shredded or lost in a back room somewhere?
The FBI has a highly secure, digitized system for managing its cases. And you have to remember that the FBI has developed in the last 15 years in a way that keeps in mind a spy who did a lot of damage to the FBI named Robert Hansen, who spied, incidentally, for the Russians for about 18 years. And he did a lot of damage. So a lot of the current security systems are built around preventing anyone from having unauthorized access. You just can't go into a back room and start, you know, shredding things or set fire to things in a wastebasket. It's not possible, and you would be caught.
Okay, so in other words, there's a very, very significant internal culture of completing the job, a very big sense of what that job would be, a high level of integrity for the documentation. The picture you're drawing up is one in which it might not actually be that important to the investigation that the director of the FBI has been changed.
Yes, the FBI director controls certain things like priorities of the entire agency, budget, but on the ground, the day-to-day next step that's being taken in an investigation, no, the director probably wouldn't be in the weeds at that level.
I love that expression, in the weeds. James Comey wrote a memo, didn't he, after meeting President Trump. Is that standard practice?
If there's one complaint in the FBI, it's too much paperwork. So, you know, when you look at these TV shows and you see all this exciting stuff that FBI agents are doing, they do that, but it's about 25% of the job. The other 75% is writing it all up and making sure it goes in a file. So there is a culture of when you are working in your official capacity and you do an interview, you write it up and you make sure that it's a part of the case file. In Comey's case, I think that it would make sense that he would do that. There's an ongoing investigation that may potentially implicate the president itself.
So when you have a situation whereby an FBI person has a memo like that, and the person who they were meeting with says, I don't recognize that meeting from that memo, who would you be inclined to believe?
I mean, in this situation, Comey is a lawyer. He worked for the Justice Department. He headed the FBI. He has a high degree of integrity. He has a pretty unassailable reputation, even if some of his actions last year were controversial. And I think it would be very hard to impugn something that he put down.
Okay, let me cut straight to the chase here. So if Comey says this happened and wrote a memo about it afterwards, and Donald Trump says it didn't, the chances are that Comey is telling the truth.
I would be inclined to believe Comey's version.
Okay, now, moving on from the FBI for a moment, we now have a special counsel, or sometimes called a special prosecutor.
Mueller.
Robert Mueller. I think he's the third, isn't he, or something?
Yes, he's known as Bobby Three Sticks in the Bureau. And the three sticks being the third, the three lines after his name.
Okay. And he was appointed by the Deputy Attorney General, but not the Attorney General. Why is that?
So the Attorney General, I believe approximately about a month ago, had to recuse himself from any investigation pertaining to Russia because he had misrepresented during his confirmation hearings his own contacts with Russia. And for this reason, there were calls for him to recuse himself, which he did. So this basically put the Deputy Attorney General in charge when it came to any aspect of this investigation. Now, the Deputy Attorney General wrote the memo outlining some of what he believed were Comey's missteps last year with regard to the Hillary Clinton email investigation, which the president initially, at least, relied upon as the basis for firing Comey.
Until he said that he was going to do it anyway.
Until he said that he was going to do it anyway. But this puts the Deputy Attorney General in slightly difficult situation because he's now implicated in the decision to fire Comey also. And now if there's a question on what the reasons were for firing Comey and whether it was to try to hinder or impede the Russia investigation. So to avoid any appearance of conflict, he appointed the special counsel. And it's for this very kind of situation that the special counsel exists.
What does the special counsel do that the FBI can't do? Why have it?
Okay, so this is important to understand. The FBI is going to continue its investigation. It's not that the special counsel now takes over the investigation. What the special counsel does is basically step into the shoes of the attorney general, or in this case, the deputy attorney general, and essentially now coordinates with the FBI in terms of this investigation. The criminal division now will continue any criminal lines of inquiry. And when they build enough evidence to potentially have a case, they'll take it to the special counsel. And the special counsel will review that evidence, decide whether there is enough there to bring charges. So that's really what the role here is of the special counsel.
Can President Trump tell Rosenstein to fire Mueller?
He could. He could do that.
Can I put you slightly to the test here? How quickly do you think we can expect results from these investigations? I mean, what sort of very rough timeline are we looking at?
It's really hard to say, David. I think some could happen in months. I mean, the other thing to remember, and we haven't talked about this yet, is that there's also these other congressional investigations happening. And so sometimes when people perjure themselves in front of Congress, that can be the basis of charges. So that could happen pretty quickly if you, you know, go lie to Congress.
Well, Asha Rangappa, that's a brilliant moment because you it's what we call in radio a segue, because that's exactly what I want to go on to now. And thank you very much indeed. So what we're hearing is that this is all very political. And joining us now is Niall Stanage. He's the White House columnist for the American political newspaper The Hill. He covers Capitol Hill, where Congress is. Niall Stanage, you've had a busy week.
Yes, there's been plenty to write about and plenty to cover, certainly.
I suppose the thing that that exercises me is the question about whether, in the end, this is all just a partisan question, whether the Democrats will just line up against Trump no matter what, Republicans will line up for him no matter what, or is there... I think the phrase that was used was staying true to our founding ideals. You heard that earlier in Neil Rozelle's package.
I think that that is a rather noble way of putting it. And I'm not sure how many members of Congress in their heart of hearts subscribe to that. But the point I would make, David, is the fact that they don't look at it in that fashion doesn't necessarily mean that this divides along straight party lines. And what I mean by that is there has always been a pretty deep skepticism about Donald Trump among the Republican Party, actually, and particularly office holders. So even before we got to the special counsel stage, there were more than a dozen Republican senators who had expressed some level of concern or criticism about the firing of James Comey. And there have been at least a couple of congressmen on the Republican side who have, in a reasonably direct way, raised the prospect of impeachment.
What actually is impeachment?
So people think that impeachment and removal from office are synonymous. They are not the same thing. Bill Clinton was impeached, but clearly not removed from office. Impeachment is the process by which you essentially say a president has a case to answer. And to even get to that point, you need a committee of the House of Representatives and then a majority in the full House of Representatives to impeach the president. If that happens, it proceeds to the United States Senate, and they vote on essentially whether to acquit the president or to hold him guilty. In order for a president to be removed from office, a full two-thirds of the US Senate needs to vote for that.
What are the things that you have to be guilty of in order to get that passed against you?
Ultimately, on a practical sense, it means whatever the House of Representatives and two-thirds of the Senate decide it means. And now there are obviously political dynamics that they need to be aware of, but it's not as if there is a statute saying high crimes and misdemeanors meaning X, Y, and Z. That's not how it's laid out.
Does obstruction of justice also mean whatever they say it means? I mean, I can't help recalling, because I'm so ancient now, that by and large, Democrats thought that Bill Clinton was not responsible, guilty of obstruction of justice, and Republicans thought that he was. Now, as we know, either he was or he wasn't. So that seems to be a movable feast as well.
It does. I mean, there are, as always, legal fine points that one can split hairs over. One key question is whether there is a provable or manifest intent to obstruct justice or to frustrate an investigation. I mean, clearly, an individual citizen can be found guilty of obstruction of justice. It is a criminal offence. But your point, I think, is well made, David, that when it comes to votes in the House of Representatives or the Senate, obviously party allegiances play some part.
Okay, so it's a very politicised business. We know that there's a Republican majority in both houses of Congress. So if anything was to happen which was to cause Trump to be impeached and then to be convicted, some Republican people would have to put up for that. Which people should we look at to know whether this is going downhill for President Trump or whether he's going to stay safe?
I think in the Senate, John McCain, who many of your listeners will most identify as the Republican nominee for president back in 2008, is a key figure to watch. He has already drawn a comparison with Watergate in terms of President Trump's conduct. He has not said anything approximating that he would support impeachment, but he has certainly been very critical. And of course, let's not forget there's history there. President Trump had, as a candidate, mocked John McCain, who was a prisoner of war during the Vietnam War, for having got captured. But McCain's a key figure. There are other Republican senators, Dean Heller in Nevada, who faces re-election next year and is one of the Democrats' top targets. Bob Corker of Tennessee has said that the administration is in a downward spiral. One final point, if I could, on this subject, David. It's not just about looking at members of Congress. One difference, I think, in the American political culture over the British one is that we have these extremely influential conservative talk show hosts on both radio and television. If, for example, Rush Limbaugh, a very well-known conservative radio host, were to somehow come out in favour of impeachment, which seems a rather unlikely prospect, but if he did so, that would have more influence in practical terms than almost any lawmaker.
Yeah, they should have put shock jock somewhere in the Constitution, shouldn't they? Kind of Article 4 or something like that. Where does it leave Comey in all this? Do you think he'll testify?
To be perfectly honest, I don't think there'd be any great reluctance on Comey's part to testify. He did refuse one invite a few days ago, reportedly because the invite was to testify in private. There was fairly authoritative reporting suggesting that he would prefer to testify in public.
One last question. We had Watergate, and then after that, as a result, we had White Watergate. We were struggling. What do we call this one?
Well, Flynn-gate is one possibility, since Michael Flynn is at the centre of it. Comey-gate, if we regard it as the real core of the case, being the suggestion that President Trump lent on James Comey to stop the Flynn investigation. But there has not, you're quite right, been a definitive term coined as yet for all of this, this whole episode.
Can we suggest Russia-gate?
Russiagate might work. It could do the business. Maybe that's the one that you should try to use the BBC's influence to propagate into wider currency.
I don't think we dare. Well, thank you very much indeed, Niall Stanage. And my thanks also to Paul Wood, to Asha Rangappa. There won't be a briefing room next week, but we'll be back in July. That's all for this episode of The Briefing Room. I'd like to thank my guests, Paul Wood, Asha Rangappa and Niall Stanage. My producer for this edition was Neil Rozelle. Additional research and production was by Sarah Shabir, Serena Tarling and Javier Zapata. If you have thoughts about The Briefing Room, there's an easy way to share them. Just write a review or rating on iTunes or your podcast provider. For those of you who've already done so, thanks. We read them all. And before you go, please check out the coming edition of Profile. They're looking at Robert Mueller.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.